Blog Talk Radio.
You're the light, you're the night, you're the color of my blood. You're the cure, you're the pain, you're the only thing I want to touch.
Welcome to Cultural Conversations with me, your host and producer, Verona Mitchell. Join us as we bring weekly cultural topics right here to our studio. You, as our studio audience, are welcome to chime in and call the studio or join us on chat. Because, you know, at Cultural Conversations, we believe that cultural issues really do shape and impact our world. So, join us as we discuss the hottest topics and the cultural issues of our day. Stay tuned. Well, good evening and welcome to another segment of Cultural Conversations with me, your host and producer, Verona Mitchell. Tonight we have a special guest in our online studio, Mr. Harold Michael Harvey. Mr. Harvey will talk about his new book, Justice in the Round, the American Jury System, and we'll get to know a little bit more about Mr. Harvey in his writing and also his perspective on the American jury system. As we look at our everyday dealings with the American jury system or the justice system, sometimes we don't completely understand all the facets to that particular system. So tonight we have an expert guest who will deliver or enlighten us on some of what we're seeing in our intimate communities, what we're seeing as we see policing and community policing and involvement, what we're seeing as we go to court, and just the overall justice system. How do we engage and what are the underpinnings or tenets of the justice system there? Tonight on Cultural Conversation, we want to extend our condolences to the family of the 9 martyrs that lost their lives in the Carolinas past week at Mother Emmanuel's Methodist Church. We want to just extend loving vibes, positive vibes to those family members that are left to struggle, and also those family members that are left with memories of their loved ones and then the tragic ending of their loved ones' lives. We extend our condolences and we extend our love and support of those families, and may God wipe every tear away and mend every broken heart there. And so, again, we want to extend that to the families of those martyrs, those 9 martyrs that lost their lives on last Wednesday. If you would like to call in the show at any time tonight, please feel free to do so. Again, this is Cultural Conversations with your host and producer, Verona Mitchell. And, of course, we bring timely cultural topics to the forefront in our online studio. I want to also thank you for being such a dedicated listening audience as we bring different cultural topics to you. Our online studio line, if you would like to chime in, is 347-857-3121. Again, that online studio number is 347-857-3121, and I'm pretty sure we'll come across a question or a topic where you would like to chime in, or you would like to get clarification on something that you've been mulling over as you engage in your community. Also, I want to let you know that our chat room is open, our online chat room. If you would like to participate, by engaging in conversations in the chat room, you are free to do so here at Cultural Conversations. Our guest tonight, excited about this guest, is Harold Michael Harvey, Justice in the Realm, the American Jury System. And we'll be right back starting this cultural conversation with Mr. Harold Michael Harvey. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Cultural Conversations with me, your host and producer, Ravona Mitchell. Tonight's guest, Harold Michael Harvey, will talk about his new book, Justice in the Realm, The American Jury System. Mr. Harvey is author of the new book, Justice in the Realm. He will give his perspective on the country's racial dynamics at play in the American jury system. And just to give you a little insight about Mr. Harvey, he is the author of the critically acclaimed legal thriller, Paper Puzzles, and author, of course, of the new book, Justice in the Realm. He formed the Cascade Publishing House to publish his work, not only his work, but the works of other authors who feel more comfortable in a smaller publishing house. Mr. Harvey, he's won many, many awards, and I'm going to get him on the line right now so he can tell you about the many accolades that he brings forth and the awards that he's won. He's very learned and just filled with knowledge, and I'm excited to have him on the show tonight to talk about his latest book and also talk about the other book that he's written, too, because that's just researching that one. That one was pretty hot as well. So, without further ado, I welcome to our online studio here at Cultural Conversations, Mr. Harold Michael Harvey. Mr. Harvey, you are on the line with Cultural Conversations. Welcome.
Good evening. Welcome. How are you today?
I am doing good. I am doing good, and I feel tremendously blessed that I have you in the studio. I've been doing a little research on actually the book, Justice in the Realm, and I know we're going to talk about that, but I also teach. I teach at a college, and I'm always looking for interesting texts to bring to my students, and I'm taking a list, and that's one of them. Your book is one of the texts that I want to bring there to that university. So could you tell our listening audience a little bit about yourself, where you went to school, and how you got into the publishing business and the writing business?
Okay, I'm probably the last person to talk about me because I don't take myself too important. But I grew up in middle Georgia, Macon, Georgia is where is my home. I was in that first class of African-American students who integrated the junior high school in my hometown back in mid-1960s. I guess 50 years ago in September, it'd be 50 years in September that we did that. And I was reacquainted this past weekend at a book signing for Jefferson Around with two of my classmates from that experience. And I went to from there, I went to college at Tuskegee Institute, now Tuskegee University. From there, I went to law school at Atlanta Law School. I worked as a teacher and a journalist for about a seven-year period before going back to school. Practiced law for about 20 years, got out of the business a little over 10 years ago, and about 8 years ago, I discovered, you know, my real passion was writing. I worked as a journalist for a few years before going back to law school, going to law school, and, you know, so when I find myself with, you know, not a whole lot to do, I resorted back to really what I want to do in life, and that was to write. And my first degree is in political science, so I have this interest to write about politics. And, of course, with having the legal education, I also now have begun to use the knowledge I have acquired from school and from the active practice to write about legal issues. And how I get into publishing is that when I published my first book, which is a novel, Paper Puzzle is a legal thriller, a really very exciting novel book that I would recommend to your students as well. But when I published that book with a traditional publisher, I found that I was doing all the work and not making very much of the money. You know, so I researched the publishing industry and found out the ins and outs of it and realized that I could do what they do, you know, for myself. And so I formed this company, I believe in 2010 or 2011, and negotiated myself out of a contract I had with the initial publisher and republished a second edition of Paper Puzzle. And, you know, it did real well. And I reaped the benefits from the financial benefits for how well it did in the end. But in the beginning, the first year or so, I was not receiving the benefits of it. So I tried to figure out how I could do that. And I had actually been asked by a major university publisher for the manuscript of Justice and Around. And the manuscript actually stayed with that publisher for a year. And I didn't hear anything out of them. And, you know, one morning I just woke up in February one morning and, like, the light went off. You know, there's a good reason why you haven't heard anything about from them on this manuscript, because I do not pull any punches. My narrative of what is wrong with the jury system is probably a fresh and unique view that, you know, no one has ever talked about or written about. And I think that publishing house just wasn't comfortable with it. And so when that light went off, I says, well, so you're going to have to do this yourself again. So I did, you know. Mm-hmm. And that's how I come to the publishing end of this.
Well, I think that, you know, just looking at your, you know, the path that you took to get to this point, and it seems like the universe has lined up. And when I said it seems like the universe has lined up, we have these things that are going on, current events and things that are going on in our world. And maybe, you know, for talking to my 75-year-old mother, they have always been going on, you know, where we had a struggle with the justice system. We didn't understand things that were going on in our community. But for the greater part, we didn't understand why we weren't connected to the bigger picture of the justice system. We saw it in a different way. And you point out something in the book in the very, very first, in the beginning, and it's based on the Martin and Zimmerman case. And with the Martin and Zimmerman case, and I'll let you get into deeper, but I think even if we go back to, like, the O.J. Simpson case, we had two different communities and two different groups of people looking at it two different ways. And then with the Martin and Zimmerman case, here we were again at that point. And then a decision was made, and not everyone understood that decision. And it was, again, our justice system failed. So you heard these messages, our justice system has failed us. And is the justice system designed for everyone? And I think that's my greatest question that I want to get out of this conversation. But could you enlighten us on a little bit about that?
You know, that is a good question. And, you know, when you look at the history of our relationship, African-Americans' relationship with this country, you have to conclude that when the framers of the Constitution created that magnificent document, you know, it did not include us, because in that document we are identified as three-fifths of a person. So we were property or chattel, or we are ancestors of those persons who were identified as three-fifths of a person. And so the document is written to judge Europeans, to slap Europeans on the wrist if they get out of line. Well, and up until the ending of the Civil War in 1865, you know, blacks were not brought before the courts, because whoever owned their property, you could do whatever you wanted to with your property, so you didn't have to bring it to court unless some other European made a claim on your property, and that's how a black person got into the courts. But it wasn't about them. It was fights between neighbors. You know, so the system, the Constitution, didn't have us in mind, and when we are woven into this fabric via the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment, the country still is not willing to accept us as equal citizens. And so the law wasn't designed to deal with our relationships between Africans and Europeans. I hate to just be so blunt, but that's the truth of it. And that's why we're having the problems we're having today. So when we fast forward and come down through time into the 21st century, and we're looking at the Trayvon Martin case, and we're looking at the Jordan Davis case, we've got human beings who's sitting in judgment of those cases, whose mental processes have been shaped, by the way the Constitution was framed. It has been shaped in separate but equal. It's been shaped in bigotry and prejudice and racism. You know, so therefore, the decisions that comes out of a body like that has to bear the fruit that produced it. And that's why we got the jury verdicts that we did in those two cases. Although we being African Americans, have always pushed the system for justice, our voices have not always been heard. I mean, they hear our voices now. I don't know that we're getting the correct response that we want at this point, but at least they're being heard now. But up until this point, although we were struggling and seeking justice, our push wasn't felt. You know, so I don't know if I'm answering your question, because it's very a complex person, but it has to do with the legal relationship between African Americans and the American government. And that relationship goes back to when the first black kid came up missing on the west coast of Africa. When the people looked around, they didn't see the sun, and he was shepherded away into a ship and brought to these shores. It's that relationship. Did you interrupt?
So when we think, and thank you for bringing in that historical part, because I think it's very important, and it leads me to the next question of definition and defining, because when I think about the justice system, I think about a higher governance system, that if someone commits a crime in my neighborhood, or even if it's out of my neighborhood, that I know that they're going to go through a due process, and they're going to go through a process, and if they commit a crime, they're going to pay for that crime. And I'm more. This is a guaranteeing body. I'm looking at the justice system as a guaranteeing body that you're impartial, and you're guaranteeing body that it due process will take place, and the obvious will be the obvious, and if they didn't commit the crime or it's not proven that they commit the crime, the justice system will determine that they didn't commit the crime. That's my definition of the justice system. And
that is how it should be, and that's a good definition of what that's an aspiration, actually. We're told that is what the justice system is, but actually that is an aspirational statement. That's what we aspire to, because that is not what we produce. And the reason we do not produce that colorblind or that truth-based justice system is because that the human beings who are called upon to judge, either by being a juror or by being the judge, bring to the courthouse every day that they come into the courthouse, they bring their collective baggage with respect to how they view other people who are different from them. And so we get a human interpretation of what truth is, as opposed to allowing the truth to speak. You know, when lawyers pick juries, it's called voir dire. You're voir dire in the jury, and that is a French term which means to speak the truth. And I always like to tell my jurors when I'm picking them that, you know, you're going to take an oath. If you're selected, you're going to take an oath that your verdict is going to speak the truth of what happened out there, because I wasn't there. You weren't there. The witness is going to testify. There'll be some documents that you have also an opportunity to observe and review. But you determine what those facts are. See, the jury, there are two judges in the courtroom, and I like to always tell my juries that they are the judge of the facts. If I said you hit me first, and you said I hit you first, you only were defending yourself, it is for them to say who hit who first. And if I come to the courthouse predisposed to be in favor of the man in the situation, I'm going to rule in favor of the man. Or if I come into the courthouse predisposed to want to support women's rights, I'm going to support the woman. And it really doesn't matter what those facts are and what the evidence is. And I think that's how we came to those jury verdicts in the George Zimmerman and the Michael Dunn trial, the first two that really started the country to boiling over justice in America.
Yeah, I thank you for defining that and what actually how we perceive the justice system and how we wish for it or aspire for it to work and how it actually is working. And yeah, we need to be reminded sometimes that these are individuals, they're human, they're people who bring their own perspective into the courthouse or into that to sit on that jury. And but a lot of times, even with the media, it's always portrayed, or it seems to be more often portrayed, the human side is taken out and they're just looking at the law, they're just looking at facts, but that's, you cannot operate in this human world without being a human and having your own kind of perspective about it. Even though, you know, I've sat on juries and they interview, they go with their little interview and ask questions, and the other lawyer or the prosecutor come in and ask a question, they're trying to disqualify you or what have you. We're human, and of course you go onto those juries having your own kind of ideas and perspective. So thank you for reminding us that. Tell us a little bit about the book. Well, tell us about the book. Where does the book start and the dynamics of some of that book?
It starts with an opening statement, which I actually started writing the opening statement probably in 2009. Even that was before I had conceived the idea of the book. I had a college classmate who who told me I needed to write something. I was waiting. I was in this limbo period of my book being at the publishers, waiting for that book being paid proposal. My first book was at the publisher. I was getting ready for it to come out. So I'm in this anticipation of how well will pay proposal be received, and I just can't wait for it to get out. But I'm not writing, I'm not doing anything, and I'm kind of a little bored. And I had a college classmate that said, you just need to write something. So I started writing an essay. And I wrote on that essay, I guess, for about 5 or 6 years until probably wrote the last words. I have to look at the book to see, but maybe it was March or April of this year. But I take that essay and I wrap it around a series of columns that I had written on the Michael Dunn trial for the murder of Jordan Davis and the George Zimmerman trial for the murder of Trayvon Martin. I covered those trials for allvoices.com. I had wrote for them for several years. And so I took these essays that I wrote contemporaneously with the trial taking place, and I sandwiched them in between an opening statement and a closing argument, just as you would do in court. And in the closing argument, I think I make the case for what ultimately has to happen that hasn't happened in this country is that we, in African Americans, have never been compensated for our forced labor. And and because we've never been compensated for that forced labor, the our government has never recognized or never apologized for the inhumanity that they committed against us. Because the root of that enslavement period is the fruits that are being bared out now in the justice system and in what is happening in the streets of America today. We have finally, in the 21st century, rose. A generation of young people have arisen that are saying enough is enough. We want to be free to live our lives without being hassled by cops. If we go, when I leave my home in the morning, I want to be able to come back and not be shot because, you know, I was stopped by the police because I was black. I was ticketed because I was black, and because I questioned the authority of the police, I challenged whether or not they had the authority to cite me when I was a law-abiding citizen. And I end up dead. So, you know, I think that the country has never apologized. And so what we need is a reparatory justice. The country has to repay us for that. And the first thing to do in repairing the breach is to say we're sorry. Just like those family members last week said, that I forgive you to a person who has never asked them for forgiveness and who more than likely has not even asked God for forgiveness, but yet those family members said, we forgive you. Our country used to be as big as the families in Charleston and say to the African-American people that we forgive you for what we did. And I don't know if there ought to be some type of economic enumeration made, but an apology, a sincere apology, would go a long way to healing this breach. And because in order to make that apology, that means that the country has to acknowledge, has to begin to live a truth. You know, we live lies in America in terms of what America is, like what you enunciated as what you thought and believed justice to be. That is what the country promulgates as justice, but that is not how, that's not the practical application of the justice system in America today. And so we live a lie. We say George Washington never lied. Well, he did. You know, so we have to face the truth. And the truth of the matter is that you have a segment of your population that was uprooted from their native land, brought to these shores, and forced to relinquish their language, relinquish their religion, and to work under harsh conditions, you know, without compensation. And then when that period of enslavement was over with, they were never compensated, never given anything, land or money, that would enable them to begin to build wealth, the wealth that they would have built had they remained in their homeland. So that's the problem. You know, that's the problem. And I think I think that I cover that and do a pretty good job of making the case for reparatory justice in the closing argument. That's justice in the round in a nutshell.
Wow. That's a history lesson, and it also is a projection of what we need in order to move forward. And I think, you know, and wow, your book is timely. Not saying that you wrote it kind of conditioned that we knew what the pattern of what would happen in the next, you know, in the next few years. I'm pretty sure you was just looking at the observations and the trends, but look what has happened in the last week and then the last month. And then the month before that, you know, it just kind of snowballed now, and how it ties in to justice in the round, and how it will tie in the future to justice in the round, because people, just like you said, they're at a tipping point now. And I see that tipping point not only in the African-American community or Black community, but also, we haven't talked about this, but also in the white communities or in white social circles, there is a tipping point and a cry for what is the actual truth, and the lies must be unearthed, uncovered, and exposed in order for us to move on, in order for us to heal as a nation. And I think one of the things that I heard today, as you know, I'm CNN buff. I'm looking at CNN all the time, MSNBC, but Mark Muriel came on, and they were talking about the whole flag issue, the Confederacy flag, taking down the flag, you know, things like that. And one of the things that he said, and I'm paraphrasing here, is that the only flag that we should have up is the red, white, and blue, or the stripes, you know, white, and blue. Because that unifies us as an entire country, good, bad, and different, ugly, the ugly truth, the history. It unifies us as a country. That's the only flag that should be important, and that's the only, and I thought about that when could we African Americans take pride, and this ties into the justice system as well, when could we take pride and wholeheartedly embrace this as our country?
I guarantee you, if our Southern friends would end the war, if they would end the Civil War, we would all feel as one. And that's part of the division. They lost, but they want to hold on to the Confederacy. But that thought, that idea of the Confederacy, it lost. It fought a battle, and men died on both sides of that war. And I understand that. I understand memorials and tribute to fallen soldiers, but it was a treasonous act to fire upon the Union. They had entered into a contract to become part of the United States of America. And they used force to break that contract. You remember I told you earlier I negotiated my way out of the first contract I had? That's the rule of law in America. But that's not what the Southern states did in 1860. In fact, in Sumter, South Carolina, they fired on the federal garrison there on the port in Sumter. And took over that port and was able to control the waterway. And so the war started. It started on, you know, so it was a violent overthrow. Instead of our system, it's a good system on paper because it allows for any idea to be debated, you know, in Congress. And if you can get enough votes, that's what you can do. It's far time for that flag to come down. And I think over time, you see, when all the southern states, there are about four or five states that still have them flying. When those flags down, you take a decade after that, and I guarantee you, race, you begin to see a difference in race relations. When I practiced, there was a young man who grew up in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, who had moved to Georgia and decided that he wanted to file a lawsuit against the state of Georgia to get the stars and bars to come down. And I joined that lawsuit. I think the judge decided he needed attorneys, and so I was appointed to represent him. And we fought a good fight, but it ended up, the court said he didn't have standing to bring the suit. And I recall asking my congressman, I love him to death, but I asked my congressman, John Lewis, if he would support us, because I was looking for a witness to testify. And he emphatically said, no, I will not support that lawsuit to remove the flag. And we were not successful. And a few years later, a courageous governor who had been a very conservative state senator, when he became governor, decided that it was time for that flag to come down. And so it did. It happened in Georgia, and it needs to happen in South Carolina, and I believe it still flies in Mississippi and maybe somewhere else, maybe Alabama.
And I've seen it in some parts of Louisiana as well. I know Mississippi has it ingrained, has the flag, that rebel flag ingrained into their state flag. And so it is a part of their state flag. So they have the stripe, the red and white, and then they have the, I always say, I don't even like to call it out, but they have that kind of that rebel flag in the middle as a centerpiece of their flag. So this is going to be very interesting, to say the least. But getting back to our communities, and this is a kind of like a good segue into what we're seeing in our community as well, because one of the things you said is that once that flag comes down, or once those symbols, because that flag is just a symbol, once that comes down, we'll see race relationships improving or getting better within America and within our own intimate communities. But I want to look at what has been in justice in the realm. How do we re-educate our communities or educate our communities about what's going on, how to protect themselves, how to deal with or how to engage with the justice system? Is there a manual or a how-to when it comes to how we should operate with the justice system?
I don't know if there's a manual, but, one of the first things I guess we could do is to realize that if you are stopped by the police, the police do have a right on occasions to stop you and to ask certain questions. If they ask you for ID, you have to give it to them. If they ask you if you committed any crime, of course, anything that you say can be held against you, so you don't have to answer those type questions, but you do have to engage them in conversations, and if they ask, if they give you a command, you have to follow it. If you believe that the police mistreated you, the best course of action is to follow their commands and immediately, after you are free of their control, go and file a complaint with the Internal Affairs against that police, and go get you a lawyer and sue the city or sue the county or sue the state for any abuse that you may have suffered at that police officer's hand. But I think we have to become a little bit more smarter, because it's about surviving. It's not dying for freedom. It's about surviving to be free. And so you have to make better choices. Maybe the officer is wrong and out of order, But don't give the guy an opportunity to shoot you and kill you, and you have no recourse. You know, go ahead and comply, but get the report file. You know, now in today's age with cameras, you know, there's always somebody on the sideline filming what's taking place. So you'll have that evidence. You'll have that evidence to present. And it's much better to have evidence that you can present in court and say, here's my proof right here, than for you to be laying in the morgue and your family saying, well, you know, he killed my person, and the film shows it, the video shows that he killed him, and didn't have any reason to kill him. I would much rather be able to stand in court and argue my case and get into their pocket. You know, it's
right.
What people listen to, what governments listen to, and what individuals listen to is when you get into their pocket, which leads me to a discussion that I had today with, at least that was held today in a meeting I attended with Minister Louis Farrakhan. And Minister Farrakhan is calling for a boycott of Christmas this year. And he is taking a text directly from Martin Luther King's last speech. It's, you know, we hear the media plays a lot. I've been to the mountaintop aspect of that speech, but during that speech, Martin talked. He laid out the plan, how he was going to proceed. He talked about the Poor People's Campaign, but he also talked about economic boycott. And so we didn't get there because the next day, you know, Martin was taken away from us. And so some of his lieutenants attempted to do some aspects of that, but it didn't have the impact that Martin would have had. Well, Farrakhan is calling for the economic boycott because he says that's how you get their attention. Martin knew that was a way to get their attention, and in the 50 years since his death, we have never actually done that on a concerted effort. I don't know if the African-American community will not go and shop till they drop during the Christmas season this year, but certainly we have to start making statements where we can make our statements. And, you know, I believe that we should use all available means. Malcolm X said by any means necessary. I believe by all available means. So, you know, I'm not one of those persons that says that Plan A is the best way, or Plan B is the best way, or Plan C is the best way. I think we should utilize all available means to get the attention of this government, to get the attention of the corporate America, because we want to be able to live our lives without fear of having the police shoot us down the streets, or having racists to come into our church and shoot us down as we pray.
Exactly. And we're going to talk a little bit more about that after we come back from break. But I think those are some very, very important, very extremely important to make, and extremely important as we talk about what would be some of our solutions. You know, we talk about the charge Louis Farrakhan will bring, and I know that in certain instances we have worked on looking at economic boycotts. What will actually work? What are some of the solutions? And or going to the bargaining table, or going to the negotiating table and say, hey, in order to engage and work in our communities, these are the things that we need, you know. So just like you said, looking at alternative options, or looking at many, many options, all opportunities, or all options are on the table at this moment. So we're going to be right back with Harold Michael Harvey, the author of the new book, Justice in the Realm, The American Jury System. It is a timely text. Have to go out and get it. It's on Amazon. I got a sample of the book, and we'll be downloading it onto my Amazon Fire for a read. It is substantial. It has critical content, and it will make you think. It addresses certain issues of our current times. It's worth buying, people. It is worth buying this book and really facing the music and the things that are happening in our present day society now, we can't run away from them anymore. And as Dr. Harvey said, you cannot run away from these things anymore. And so we're having a cultural conversation tonight on Cultural Conversations with Harold Michael Harvey, Justice in the Realm, the American Jury System. And we'll be right back with more of what are some of our solutions as we're getting into justice in the realm. What are our solutions in our communities and for the nation as a whole? Stay with me. Welcome back to My Cultural Conversation with your host and producer, Verona Mitchell. And I'm having a cultural conversation tonight with Mr. Harold Michael Harvey, author of the new book, Justice in the Realm, the American Jury System. This has been a very interesting conversation because we've been able to speak truth to power and shed light on what we're seeing in our engagement with law and the jury system within our communities, our own intimate community, but also some historical perspective on the development of that jury system or the justice system and parallel to that, the creation and development of this country and our hand in it and how we are monitored and our involvement in the creation of this country and the respect that we want to have and give for everyone who lives in the country. So I think this has been an enlightening conversation, cultural conversation tonight with Harold Michael Harvey. We're going to talk now about what are some of the solutions and I want to go through some of the topics, I want to go through some of the topics in the book. What would be the basic solutions here for the things that we're seeing as this racial, it seems like we're sitting on top of a racial bubble. And what are some of the solutions that you would pose, especially coming from Justice in the Realm?
You know, I didn't set out to come up with solutions. What I wanted to do was give an overview of, I wanted to give the reader a framework of what we're looking at. And I wanted to, in order to begin the conversation of how we have to, what we, to give us information that we can use to go about adjusting the system. So I don't know that I'm the person to come up with solutions, okay? I thought it was necessary to frame the conversation in, from the eyes of an African American, because what we get from the news media primarily is their discussion of justice in America, their discussion mm-hmm. of why jury verdicts were correct, why the grand jury proceeding was correct, and mm-hmm. their view the way they see life is differently from the way African Americans see life. because justice to them is not justice to us. You know, so what I wanted to do was to frame the argument from the perspective of African Americans, so that we can engage in this dialogue and we can come up with whatever those solutions are. You know, because I certainly believe that race is the biggest impediment to justice in America. And, you know, so now how do you solve the problem of racism? You know, I don't know that I'm capable or qualified to do that, but I think I certainly am able to look at history, look at the politics of history, and look at the legal history and say that we've got a problem. That problem, the big problem, is race in America, and we need to find some solutions to this problem. And if we do not find the solutions, we will sadly see more incidents like we saw last week. That was predicted, sadly, was predicted in Justice in the Round. And other calamities to come, sadly enough, or predicted in Justice in the Round, because I actually foresee that if we don't get a handle on justice for all, that our system, the very fabric of our system, is going to deteriorate to lawlessness in the streets of America.
Yeah, I do foresee that as well. And just looking at this bubble, just like I said, it's just a bubble there that's waiting to just burst, and it is a tipping point on both ends, a tipping point built on frustration of what do we do and how do we address these issues. And Justice in the Round puts it on individuals' minds that, yes, what you're seeing is what you're seeing. And now we can start the conversation on doing something about it if we choose to do something about it. Give us some contact information if people want to go out and buy Justice in the Round as we kind of end our hour here. They want to know more about how to contact you or how to purchase the book.
Well, you can contact me at haroldmichaelharvey.com. That's my blog. I try to post something 2-3 times a week. And in fact, I'm posting. I'm writing now. At least I'll post it after this interview of the meeting I had with Minister Louis Farrakhan today. He had some interesting things to say. And so, please, by all means, tonight or tomorrow, go to haroldmichaelharvey.com and read my story on Minister Louis Farrakhan's call for a boycott this Christmas. And you can buy the book at haroldmichaelharvey.com and also at Amazon, and it's available in ebook at the Amazon Kindle store. My email address is hmharvey@haroldmichaelharvey.com.
Okay.
The book sells for $16.99, so it's priced right, only price.
It is. I was surprised when I went on Amazon.com. I said, this is a fair price, and I think it may be a little less expensive if you get it on Kindle or through an e-reader or something like that. I'm not sure. It looks like $13 or something like that.
It is. It's $6.99 on Kindle. You know, so that it's very. I priced it to sell, because I want to get this information into the hands of as many people as possible.
Possible. And when you say as many people as possible, I'm looking at the audience, and if it's for our social justice individuals, it's for our progressives, it's for our political people, it's for everyone. So it's not like it's a religious text or something that's just for ministers or anything like that. This book is for everyone, right?
For everyone, and I think I wrote it on a high school level. I think age 15 on up to 100 will be able to read this book and digest the information in it. You know, and although I have the legal background, my approach, even when I practiced, was to demystify the law. So I like to break things down so that the commonness of people can understand what's going on, what the legal implications or political implications are based upon certain laws and so forth.
Mm-hmm. And that's the basic thing that we want. If you don't understand it, then that's an issue. And so it's an easy read. That's what we always say, it's an easy read. Well, as we close our hour here, Mr. Harik. Any lasting thoughts? Please bless us with some lasting thoughts here on Cultural Conversations of what we're seeing in this world. Just some lasting thoughts, especially as you have woven in your words in Justice in the Realm.
Well, we are not in a good place in the world today. We're in a bad place, and bad things are happening. They're happening for a reason. You know, there's something. God is up to something, and we can see God moving in these situations. And you know, I just believe that if humankind doesn't take a serious look at the problem of justice in this country, you know, God will step in, and we don't sometimes like God's solutions when he solves problems. You know, but I don't think we're in a good place, and I think that we are smart enough that if we have the will, we can actually resolve racism and prejudice and bigotry. We can eliminate or marginalize enough people, I mean, to make the racist, we can dwindle those numbers. Those numbers can go down, and we can put them in a place where even if you have a handful of them who have those opinions, they are so marginalized that they have no impact or effect on society. And that's what we have to do. And it is our charge to do that. And, you know, I believe growing up in the church that if we do not do that, you know, then a higher being will probably do that for us.
That's right. Amen to that. Well, I want to thank you, Harold Michael Harvey, for gracing our online studio today and talking about your new book, Justice in the Realm, the American Jewelry System. But not only talking about your new book, but also imparting history and wisdom to our listening audience tonight. Your words ring true. If we're smart, we would adhere to wisdom and really look at the observations that people such as you, such as Minister Farrakhan, such as other qualified people who study and look at our social conditions and our history and our patterns, to listen now. Now is the time to listen and to talk about those ills that we have here in the country and to be honest with each other. White, black, across all nationalities and all cultures and all races, time to come together now. So I think your book kind of steers us into that direction. So I want to thank you for joining me tonight.
I've enjoyed it. I hope that your audience has gotten something out of my time spent with you today. But I enjoyed being on the show. I appreciate you inviting me.
Thank you, and you have a wonderful evening. Well, thank you, listening audience, for joining me tonight here at Cultural Conversations. I've enjoyed that conversation. Harold Michael Harvey, write it down, author of the new book, Justice in the Realm. And he gave his perspective. He gave us wisdom. He imparted wisdom on to us. And go out to Amazon.com. It's Justice in the Realm, the American Jewelry System. And peep the book, get the sample, and purchase the book. It is a wonderful book, I can tell you, just from reading the first couple of chapters. Thank you for joining me on Cultural Conversations. Until next week.
Sitting out on the edge of paradise. Every inch on his skin.
This is Verona Mitchell, and thank you for joining me on Cultural Conversations. At Cultural Conversations, we're bringing weekly cultural issues and topics to our online studio. Join me next week as we bring more of Cultural Conversations. Thank you for joining me. See you next week.